This is a CBC podcast.
I'm Paul Kennedy, host of Ideas on CBC Radio 1. Art looks into the future through the eyes of artists. In partnership with the Sobey Art Award 2016 and the National Gallery of Canada, Ideas features the prestigious awards finalists. Go to cbc.ca/ideas to find out more.
Hi, I'm Matt Galloway. This is the Metro Morning Podcast. It's Monday. With a budget of over $1 billion, the Toronto Police Service is under pressure to reduce the cost of policing in our city. A policing task force has made recommendations to modernize the force, saving millions of dollars along the way, recommendations that include reducing the number of uniformed officers. Now, that has provoked a strong response from the union that represents those officers. The Toronto Police Association has launched a Facebook page, Stop the Toronto Police Cuts, and held a series of telephone town halls, talking about what it says will be the effect of budget cuts at the Toronto Police Service. In a few moments, we'll get reaction to that from the Chief of Police, Mark Saunders. But first, Mike McCormick, President of the Toronto Police Association, joined us.
Good morning, Matt.
What is the objective of this campaign? What are you trying to do?
Well, the objective of the campaign is to educate the public, to provide information to the public about what we think is a quite important issue, public policing, and what is going on in policing in the city of Toronto.
What is wrong with what, from your perspective, with what is going on right now in terms of reducing the cost of policing?
Well, you know, you talked about there's nothing wrong with reducing the cost of policing or looking at efficiencies and effective policing. And we're all for that. We've participated in exercises around policing, looking at, as I said, what is the most efficient way, what is the most effective way to police. But what our concern is that the transformational task force and the political masters have been sort of putting a onus on this to do it as a budgetary exercise, not looking at effective and efficient policing. You know, when a task force comes up and they say, okay, we want to have a zero net budget, and lo and behold, the task force comes out with a number that exactly dovetails the 4,760 officers or whatever, that dovetails what they're doing on a budgetary exercise. I have some concerns about that.
The task force has recommended, what, a 10% cut in uniformed officers by 2019?
An additional, I think it's around an additional 450. I'm sure the chief can get into the exact numbers, around an additional almost 500 police officers by 2019, and that's so that they can achieve a zero net budget. And if we look at our numbers where we were in 2010, for instance, we had around 5,635 officers, somewhere around there. So we're already 400 today, less than we had 5 years ago, and we're going to go down an additional 500.
What effect do you think that will have?
Well, you know, I think it's going to have an impact on service delivery. I think it's going to have an impact on response times. We've already seen priority one response times have an increase.
What does that mean?
Well, they are the most important calls that we do. Everything where you need assistance from a police officer right away, there's a suspect on scene, there's violence, all kinds of things. It is exactly as it sounds, a priority one, the most important of calls. And what we've seen is that an increase to 15 minutes to respond when the industry standard is 7 to 10 minutes. Now, not every priority one call is going to be responded. It's going to take 50 minutes. There's a smoothed out rate there. But it's a concern for us when that's increased by 5 minutes over the last 10 years.
Have you explicitly been saying that there is going to be an increase in crime if these budget cuts move forward?
No, I haven't been saying that there's going to be an increase in crime. But what I have been saying, and the evidence and science, academia backs up, is that there is a correlation between crime. There is a correlation between effectively deployed police officers, public safety, people's sense of safety in their community, and an impact on crime. And we have to have visible police officers out in the communities that do have an impact, not only, as I said, responding to crime, responding to calls for service, but also having officers out in the community. And there is an impact on crime, impact on public safety, when you have properly deployed police officers, highly visible.
Some of the people who have received these calls to participate in the telephone town hall around the cost of policing have said that this is scaremongering, that you're trying to say that there will be a spike in crime if there is a reduction in the cost of the police budget.
Nothing could be further from the truth. What we are trying to do, and the reason that we took this step, is we go out and we poll and we do focus groups and stuff like that, and we have polled the public. And what we found is less than 3% of the public were aware of what was going on with the Transformational Task Force, what was aware in what's going on in policing, and we thought it was incumbent upon us. This is all about public policing. The community will be the ones who dictate what policing is going to look like, not the politicians, not the bureaucrats, but the community. And we thought it was imperative to educate the community, let the community decide, given all the information, what type of policing do we want to see in the city of Toronto.
One of the things that you have said over the course of this campaign is that officer morale is going to be affected by these cuts. What is happening when it comes to the morale of the officers that you represent through your union?
You know, that's a really great question. And it's not only that, like, they're going to be impacted as if in the future they're going to be impacted. Right now, I would say our morale is at an all-time low with our police officers.
An all-time low?
Yeah.
Why?
Because they feel that they're going from call to call. This is the number one issue that we're dealing with. They feel like they're going from call to call. They are in a reactive mode. No time for proactive policing, and they're burning out and they're stressed out. The biggest complaint I get from our officers is that they're putting out in different divisions, sometimes 2-3 cars for an entire shift, and they get into work, calls are impending, and they're going from call to call. I just was talking to some of our officers in a downtown division on Saturday, and one of the supervisors there was telling me on his platoon, this is one platoon in a division downtown, has done over 17,000 calls so far this year. Officers, individual officers, have done over 1,000 calls. So that's something that's concerning us, that they are burning out and they are stressed.
What is the responsibility of those officers in helping to reduce the cost of policing in the city?
Well, again, you know, our officers, the responsibility of the officers is to get out there and do their jobs and provide a policing service, a public service, and to do it in an efficient way and look at that. And that's what we look at from an association perspective. And again, you know, the chief's got a very difficult job to do, and this isn't about the chief and or his role. This is about when political masters and political people.
You keep saying that political masters and political people. Who do you think is pulling the strings here?
Again, I think the Police Service Board's driving this agenda. This is all we have said from the very beginning of this exercise. This is a budgetary exercise. They're throwing things into it, like parking, for instance, where parking, well, we've got to get rid of the parking enforcement officers, you know, pay duty stuff that is a red herring that really has virtually no impact on the police budget.
Do you think those politicians, I mean, we're talking about the mayor, we're talking about other city councilors, do you think they understand the minutiae of policing as you understand it?
No, definitely they don't. I don't think they understand it on the level that I understand it. I don't think they understand it on the level of what the chief understands it. And like I said, my concern again is that, you know, when we look at that and we hear the political rhetoric around that, well, we're going to have other service delivery models. I talked to the other people within the city's people who represent bylaws, inspectors, people, mental health practitioners, they're going through the same process that we're having. So we're going to eliminate these and have alternate service delivery models with there is no infrastructure for that as well.
One of the reasons why, and we're going to get to the chief in just
sure.
a moment, but one of the reasons why those politicians who are members of the Police Services Board have been pushing for budget cuts is because for years there have been concerns around the cost of policing in this city, that this is an issue that has gone on for many, many
definitely,
years.
Definitely.
So don't you understand that the pressure that they are facing, the pressure from the average citizen in this city who, if they're concerned about the cost of policing, they want to see that cost go down?
Well, first of all, I'd be a fool if I wasn't aware of what's going on in the narrative or the dialogue around police budgets. This is something that we're fully entrenched in. But what we're asking for is an honest dialogue around police budgets. So when we look at, you know, police budgets, okay, and we look at the overall pie of the tax base going into policing, all the ever-expanding police budget, when we look at what we have taken up of that pie, which is around 9.6 to 10.1%, a 0.5 variance fluctuating,
right.
We're not taking up more of the budget than we ever had. We need to have some honest discussions around police budgets, 100%, and we need to look at some efficiencies. But when I get concerned is when I hear the politicians and the councillors saying, okay, well, we're going to drive the narrative around this, around a numerical equation to say, okay, we need to achieve a zero net budget. And, you know, this last round of bargaining from an association perspective, we dovetailed our contract around what inflation was, a realistic expectation of what police officers need and deserve to be paid in the city of Toronto with respect for the taxpayers. So we're looking at that. We're very cognizant of what's going on in policing and the budgets. And I believe we provide a great service for great value in the city of Toronto.
Listening closely to that was the chief of police, Mark Saunders, who's with us in studio now. He is the co-chair of the Task Force on Modernizing the Police Service. Good morning to you.
Happy holidays, Matt, to you and everyone listening.
To you. What do you think the union is trying to do with this campaign?
Well, you know, that's a fair question, but I'm more interested in what I'm doing, and that is modernizing the Toronto Police Service. And so when we formulated this task force, this is an exciting opportunity for us to modernize the Toronto Police Service. You can't look at me and say that the old model should be consistent with today's pressures, because that's just not fair and that's not accurate. And when I signed up to co-chair this, there's no way that I would put the public in harm, and more importantly, I would not put any of the officers in harm. So this is a really good time, and a lot of changes are going to happen, not just focusing on one element. Mm. There are so many moving parts to this report, and I think everyone seems to forget it is an entire report. It is not just a segment of a report.
So let's go back to the fair question then, which is, what do you think the union's trying to do in saying to people, this is what we think is going to happen?
Well, I think there's an opportunity for the union to have a full understanding of the report, and when they have an understanding of the report, they will understand that it's not a budget report. It is about modernization. So when we look at the goals of being where the police need it, public needs us most, and working with partnerships so that we can have more effective community safety, and looking at the complex needs of the city, then I think that the dialogue will change.
Can you reduce the number of police officers and still maintain the same level of service?
Absolutely. You know, when I looked at the report, when I was working with the report with the task force, who are some bright minds, not just from the police service, but outside of the police service as well, Matt, we're doing all kinds of things to allow better opportunities for our officers to be in the right place at the right time.
So explain how that could work, because people would say, if there aren't as many officers out on the streets, and Mike McCormick made this call, that it's going to take longer for calls to be answered.
That's
how can
right.
you have fewer officers but still maintain the same level of service?
Yeah, if we keep the same model, then the association is right. But this is going to be a new model. And within this new model, we're doing a lot of things. Number one, for example, where we're taking away the things that we don't need to do anymore. Why do we have officers doing school crossing guards? There's no need for us to be doing school crossing guards. We spent over 3,100 hours last year doing just that. Why do we go to every single festival when we're not needed? It should be threat assessed, so that is there an issue coming up, or have there been issues coming up in the past?
And your point is that those officers could be deployed elsewhere.
Oh, absolutely. We're a city of festivals, and every weekend what we do is we pack up our officers from right across the city, and they basically just corral these events. And no one's getting hurt. There are no injuries. Nothing happens. But we'll stay there from Friday at 4 o'clock all the way through Sunday.
So will we wait longer for police response to emergencies if these changes happen?
No, I've got an obligation to make sure that we do go to the priority one calls within a specified time. It is the law. And so as we move towards a new model, there will be opportunities for that. This year, we received more calls for service, but most of the calls were non-priority. We received less emergency calls. So part of the transformational task force is moving from primary to priority, which means we only go to the calls where police that are highly trained need to go to. Right now, we go to everything. We go to calls where chickens are in trees and things along those lines. These days have to stop. We have other partners that can take these calls and do those calls. And so we'll be doing that. We can change our delivery model. You don't have to have a police officer to walk up to look at a vacant parking spot to say that's where the stolen car was. It can be done through reports. It can be, if you can set up times to come in and see clerical staff. There are a whole different means in which we can leverage technology so that it's less pressure for police officers.
I want to hear more about these chickens and trees, but that's another matter entirely. One of the things he said is that there is, and it's true, there are people who believe, at the very least, that crime could go up if there are fewer officers on the streets. And people have said that this is fear-mongering, that this is scaremongering, to make those sorts of claims, to talk openly about what police, the numbers of police, are going to mean to the type of policing in the city. Do you think it's scaremongering to try and draw those conclusions?
Well, I don't think it's accurate. I mean, let's look at our homicide numbers. I mean, that's what everyone's looking at, and they're using it as comparatives to say, see, here's what's happening is we have less officers. We had more officers in 2005, 2006, 2007, 2008. And right now, year to date, we have less homicides than those years that I just mentioned. So we had more officers then, but the homicides were up more than they are today. So that's one factor. But the other thing, Matt, is we are going to be where we need to be, and we are going to be developing stronger partnerships. The one thing that we did when we went to all of these consultations, it came over and over and over again. Members of the community were saying, we need more police officers on the streets developing relationships. And if we have that, then there are opportunities for reduction of crime.
He says the morale of your officers, the officers that you represent, has never been lower. Why is that the case, do you think?
It's the fear of the unknown. The final report has not been out yet. And you know, everyone's hoping that, you know, Chief Saunders has this report that's going to be a good report. But people are concerned. They don't know what it's actually going to look like and how it's going to impact them. So as soon as the report comes out, which is in January, there is going to be a very robust messaging piece where we're going to make sure that everybody from the ground right up has a full and comprehensive understanding of the direction we're going in.
Would you agree that morale on your force is very low right now?
I would say that there are morale issues concerning not just the report, but just a lot of the rhetoric that's occurring in the States, and then social media and other media types pushing it up and saying, if it's happening there, therefore it's happening here. So yeah, there are some things that have caused morale issues for sure.
What does that say about the commitment then and the rank and file to changing the way that policing is done? Because you can have support at that from the highest level, from your office, from other commanding officers through the force. But if there is low morale because of not just the fear of the unknown, but the possibility of change, what does that say about the commitment to change?
It says very little. We have hired the best and brightest police officers in Canada. Each and every day when I read the reports of the amazing things that they do, it's a testament that if morale is low, productivity is still fine. The men and women are still doing what needs to be done to keep this the safest city in North America.
And they're willing to change the way they do that?
A lot of talk has been going on and people are excited about the change.
It's good to have you here. Thank you.
I deserve a watch for being here so much, Matt.
We'll get you a pass, Okay. Certainly. Yeah. You're always welcome. Mark Saunders is the Chief of Police for the City of Toronto. We've been talking about who has made a difference in this city over the course of this year. We call it Torontonian of the Year. We take your nominations for people who are doing interesting things, big or small, in your community and in your city. We're going to meet some of those people today. Marcia Brown is one of them. She's the woman behind Trust 15, a children and youth empowerment organization in Rexdale. She joined us this morning, along with Metro Morning listener Erica Wright. She's the manager of international marketing and communications at Humber College, and she nominated Marcia for Torontonian of the Year.
Good morning.
Along with the Metro Morning listener who nominated her. Erica Wright is manager of international marketing and communications at Humber College. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Matt. Pleasure to be here.
Glad to have you here. Congratulations on the nomination.
Thank you so much. Why
did you nominate Marcia Brown?
Well, Matt, I first heard of Marcia on this very program about 3 years ago now. I was new to the city, trying to find out what happens in the city, what goes on. And there's a lot of great things that go on in the city.
Yeah.
But working in higher education in that same community, right in the backyard, really, at the University of Guelph Humber and Humber College, I realized upon hearing about the gala and all the great work that Marcia does, that we should collaborate. So I've attended a bunch of her events. I've hosted her students on the campuses, and I see her blood, sweat, and tears, the tireless hours, the truly phenomenal vision that she's had. She saw a need in the community. She nearly single-handedly fulfilled it. And she's had a great year. I wanted to nominate her this year because it's been a big year. She's come a long way. She's been able to really grow the organization, grow the programming for the youth. I see the youth, and I can't help but cry most times. I mean, these are youth that come into the higher education system and do great things. I've seen some of the alumni come back and give back. They're public speakers, they're mentors, and I've seen some prominent people, including people in the media, people, the mayor himself, say, "Hey, these kids are going to take my job one day." They really come a long way.
Listen to all of this praise.
I know.
What is that like to hear?
It's an honor. I feel very humbled about it. You know, I wasn't thinking about it in the beginning when I started it. I saw there was a need in my community, and I know these kids needed it. And, you know, seeing them on the same streets that I walk on and being out in certain times of night and not having a role model in their life showed me that I needed to do something very quickly. We're losing our youth, and I decided to do this.
So describe what Trust 15 does.
Well, Trust 15 is a mentorship program where I encourage young kids to be leaders. What I do, I get great role models to come in and teach these kids how to speak, how to be the leader that they need to be. I have four programs that are running right now. I have Boys of Excellence, ages 7 to 12 years of age. It's run twice a week. One is a mentorship program, and on Thursdays, we do robotics. My young boys need to use their hands. They need something to believe in. Then after, when they graduate, they go into Men of Distinction. That's ages 13 to 19 years, and that's a mentorship program. Also, to encourage them to be the leaders and be and prepare them to go off to college or university. They need someone to show them the right path. Then I also have Girls on the Rise. It's a literacy program encouraging young girls to read and write. And then afterwards, they graduate into Ladies on the Rise, where it's a continue of the mentorship program to continue off to be leaders and go off to college and university.
You talked about the need that was there. What did you see in terms of a gap in these young people's lives that you thought you could help fill?
The gap I was seeing that none of them were getting the tools that they needed from home or in the community. How does it feel when you're walking out in the community and you see these young kids and you ask them what they want to do in life and they go, I don't know, you know, or they see someone who is going to lead them down the wrong path, like a, you know, like someone who wants to sell them drugs. And he said, you know what, you can make $1,000 easily in 5 minutes. Mm. You know, these young kids are going to go for that because of what they have at home. They have nothing, so they're going to try. So what I try to do is make sure I bring in great role models to come in and show them the right tools and the right path they need to go, telling them that education is the key if you wanted to have that kind of life. And if someone does not show them that, they're going to continue down that path of listening to the wrong people.
What change have you seen in their lives?
Oh my goodness. A lot of them have gone off to college and university by, they've been thanking me and telling me, Mrs. Brown, because of you and because of the people that you brought into my life, I have hope again. I can leave this community now and I can go different places. This summer, I took 56 kids to Ottawa and they were able to meet, have high tea with Madame Trudeau. That does not happen in my community. You know, these kids came back and they're different.
Back to Rexdale.
Came back to Rexdale and they're totally different. Now, you know what else we did? We went to Ottawa and we stayed at the university campus, right? Where they were able to stay at the dorms. They were able to see professors because what I did, I tried to find out what these kids wanted to be in life. And I got to match them up with these professors to come in and speak to them.
What did you mean when you say that doesn't happen in my community?
It doesn't happen that much. I'm not saying that not everything is bad. What I'm saying is that most of the kids I speak to are telling me that they don't know what they want to do, or they don't even leave the community. They just stick right there and they think there's no other way but staying in the community. So they don't know what's out there. So my job is to make sure that I take them out of the community and show them there's so much out there for them to experience. And it has changed them. And now my kids are going off to different schools. They're meeting amazing people who are mentoring them right now and showing them that, you know what, this is your life and we're going to make sure it happens.
Blood, sweat, and tears. How much time do you put into something
24/7. 24/7. But I love it. I love it because at the end of the day, when I go home to my family, I know those kids are going to have hope. They have hope. And I will continue to do it until I cannot do it anymore.
This is the kind of thing that has attracted a lot of attention. We played earlier this little clip of Damara Carroll showing up there. I mean, he heard about this.
Yes, he did.
And somehow figured out that he wanted to come up and see what was going on.
And you know what? None of the kids knew. That was my surprise for
Suddenly
them.
A raptor shows up and they go crazy.
And they were crying. They were jumping up in joy. They were clapping. He heard their stories, why each of them are in the program. You can tell that he really appreciates these young kids and where they were going.
Erica, you said that you were new to Toronto. You were listening to this program, trying to figure out what was going on. You heard about Marcia's work, but then you said there are a lot of really good things that are going on in this city.
Yeah.
I mean, again, it's kind of, people have been saying that 2016 has been a bit of a miserable year for a bunch of different reasons. What good is happening in the city that we don't know about?
Well, I think things like this, I'm sure we'll hear from other nominees. I see, you know, great things happening. Across not just throughout North Etobicoke, but the neighborhood I live in. We've got, you know, delivery of local produce happening. We've got, you know, people farming in the city. We've got, you know, more people talking about transit, more people talking about community building and knowing your neighbor. And it's those things that have a snowball effect. And that's why I think this is so important. Mm. And so deserving of this nomination, if not the award, because we don't even know the potential impact. I know I've seen and talked to a lot of these youth, but the snowball effect that this programming will have and what the potential that Marcia untaps in this youth is, it's really infinite.
Well said. Thanks for listening, and thanks for nominating her. And congratulations on the nomination and all the great work that you're doing.
Thank you so much.
That's Marcia Brown. and Erica Wright. It is easier to set Canadian records than take a stupid photograph. That line is from a piece by Lanny Marchand in I Run magazine. The Olympian and marathon record holder ran it after a photo that she took, a cover photo for that magazine, was declined by the magazine for being, in its words, too sexy. Lanny Marchand joins me now to talk about advocacy, gender, and double standard in sport.
Morning.
This started for you not with the magazine and the photo shoot, but it actually started when you were in Ottawa. Mm-hmm. And you were speaking about women in sport to, a parliamentary committee on sport. What happened?
I was asked to go speak up about women in sport at the Heritage Committee in front of the House of Commons. And I jumped at the opportunity. I thought it was great. I had a lot of important points that I wanted to raise and discuss and thought I had done an okay job. And then afterwards, I found out that my words actually didn't matter. The one statement that I made during an hour-long discussion, I'd said, don't comment on my body, comment on my performance. And apparently, because of how I choose to dress when I compete and because of the photos I've done for magazine covers previously, I was told by a lot of people out there that I'm not allowed to say that, that if I'm going to choose to compete in a bra top and brief bottoms, everyone's allowed to comment on my body, and not even in such a way that it's an athletic comment that I'm muscular, I'm fit. If people want to comment and diminish my performance because they think I'm hot or I'm sexy, they're allowed to do that. My words don't matter. My performances don't matter.
What have you heard from people over the course of your extraordinary career about appearance? What have people said to you, not about how fast you run, but about how you look?
A lot of times I receive comments when I finish a race of, I can't believe you just ran a marathon. You look beautiful. And I'm like, I'm not out here trying to look like anything but a runner. And, you know, as a female, I think it's a hard line to draw because we are told to care about our appearances and we are, you know, we have to kind of present ourselves as put together. But when I'm running a marathon, there's nothing sexy and there's nothing pretty about it. I can tell you that. It's hard work. And I've put in just as much work as my male counterparts. And if you're not going to comment on them, and if you think they look sexy or hot, then don't comment on me that way.
This leads then to this conversation that people are having about the magazine. And the photo that you took that has been circulating around, and the photo, I guess, that they didn't run. What was the picture that the magazine declined to run because they thought it was too sexy?
It was one where I was actually in a collared shirt because I'm a lawyer as well, and I'm a lawyer by day. And I'm in a collared shirt, and I'm sitting on a chair, and I'm holding a pair of running shoes, and it's supposed to be this play on my double life. And they decided that it was too overtly sexual. And I'm sitting there going, I'm wearing clothes, and I get maybe the pose in some minds could be a bit provocative, but not, because if I had been a man and I'm lounging in a big open arm chair with my shirt unbuttoned and open, and there's running shoes scattered around me, that would be seen as powerful and sexy. Yeah. But me sitting on, like, posed on a chair holding my running shoes was too sexy and not powerful.
And so your response in part is to write about it, but also to take another photo.
Yeah, because what I did in my frustration is all I did was Google Canadian Olympians shirtless. And all of these images popped up, and an I Run magazine photo came up. And it was the one that's in my article of Adam Vancouverden. And I'm sitting there going, how is me with clothes on still too sexy, but in a running magazine, a canoe kayaker can be posing with no shirt on? Male runners, professional male runners, don't run shirtless. So if you're going to be on the cover of a running magazine, why isn't he wearing a shirt? And that developed into this conversation about the female body being just inherently more sexual, and Adam's shirtless, and I'm half naked.
What were you trying to achieve in having this broader conversation? The response has been a very lively one, and a lot of people have gotten involved in this. But what were you trying to do with this?
I tried the verbal approach. I'd gone to the House of Commons. I'd had a lot of important things to say. In interviews after that, I, you know, had a lot of important things to say and pointed out, like, I'm doing this for my nieces and for your daughters and for your sisters and the women in your family, that whether it's on the field of play or in a professional aspect of our lives, what we do matters, not how we look doing it. And so I realized that my words weren't necessary. My words were falling on deaf ears, and maybe people are more visual learners, and maybe people would get it if I show exactly the same amount of skin as Adam, actually less, if people would understand what I'm saying.
What has to change, not just for yourself, but for the broader conversation to alter so that people are focusing on achievement, as you said, and not how people look?
Take gender out of it as best we can, whether it's women's soccer or men's soccer. They're athletes out there, they're soccer players, and comment on their performances. And again, especially in my sport, my body is very much my equipment. There's going to be comments on my body. I'm not pretending that's not going to happen. But even like I testified in front of the House of Commons, if you want to comment on my behind, comment on it because it's muscular. And comparative to other distance runners, maybe I'm more muscular than others. Very much my body is what I do. Every athlete, it's what we do. And there's going to be comments about it. But what you find sexy isn't what I find sexy or somebody else. So don't put your labels on my body and take gender out of it. Our performances, we're athletes first, we're male or female second.
Are you encouraged by the response?
I have been, yes. Yeah. It's been very positive.
You're new to, you're living now here in Toronto?
Yes.
That's awesome. Why did you move here? You were down in Memphis?
My job's still in Tennessee. And I'll split my time there. But instead of having seven different homes that I rotate through the year, I wanted a Canadian hub, and why not have it be Toronto? Toronto's been good to me with my records and my Olympic qualifiers and my Pan Ams medals, so it seemed like a good place to be.
We're glad you're here. People keep reporting on being passed by you as they're out running. I look forward to that opportunity. In the meantime, thank you.
Thank you.
Slania Marchant. You can read what she wrote, see the photo that she took, and more on Twitter at Metro Morning or cbc.ca/Metro Morning. That's the podcast for Monday. I'm Matt Galloway.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.